Welcome to a bonus episode with Jack Goldstone from Series 2 of The Thought Exchange. If you have listened to previous episodes, then welcome back. But if this is your first time, then just let me explain a little bit about The Thought Exchange. These podcasts are an informal and relaxed conversation with people I've met or worked with in my career, or with strangers whose work and ideas interest me. When you're in conversation with people, you aren't seeing them in formal lecture settings or seeing them trying to condense their thoughts for the restrictive format of a TV program or radio interview. You get to have a proper exchange. Don't expect an interview. These are rolling discussions which cover topics close to my heart and close to the heart of the interviewee. I'm keen to engage and learn from anyone who listens. Help me get better at what I'm doing, direct me to other sources of learning, suggest other interviewees, drop me a line on Twitter at Piers_Lee, or go to Patreon to support the podcast. But for the moment, just relax, unwind, absorb and enjoy. This episode of the podcast is actually a bonus episode with Jack Goldstone. During our conversation, I asked Jack to talk me through three specific examples of social change which help illustrate his model. The British Revolution, the American Civil War and the Chinese Revolutions, which ended with Mao and the Communist Party entering Beijing in 1949. When listening back and editing the main podcast, I felt that these three examples needed to be lifted and put in a separate podcast with space to breathe. Doing so has allowed the main podcast to have a better flow, but this extra episode will allow anyone interested in these ideas to go a little deeper with a lot more detail. These conversations have been conducted by conference call, and the audio has been recorded using voice memo on a phone. So if the audio isn't what it should be, then I apologise and beg your indulgence. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. But I think what would be really useful to me, I read Revolutions, a very short introduction, that's it, which I thought was really clearly and simply written, much to its benefit. But I think it would be really useful for me to look at some examples and the model that we've been talking about, how we see that manifest in those specific examples. Because there's three examples which really jumped out of the page at me, because they're very, very different. And that's the British Civil War, the Civil War in the US, and then the Chinese Revolution. Now, they're very different in nature and then very different in terms of, you know, time frames. Could we just go through sort of one of those at a time, looking at the conditions which fulfill your model in terms of each of those incidents, starting with the British Civil War?
Sure. Well, the British Civil War, sometimes called the Puritan Revolution, really involved all of Great Britain, Scotland, Ireland, England, and Wales. It developed in the 17th century after about a century and a half of unexpectedly strong population growth in Britain, brought largely by kind of warmer weather. We had a medieval cold period, and then temperatures after the Black Death started to warm up, and the population recovered and kind of continued to surge. And as the population grew, the city of London, I wouldn't say exploded, but the city of London really started to grow rapidly and attract a lot of traders and merchants and artisans and apprentices. And the society got more, what we would almost call more modern in a sense. People got more specialized in their jobs. There was more internal trade. And things were quite good, actually, kind of up through the time of William Shakespeare. We kind of think of the prosperous Renaissance Elizabethan England. But in the early 17th century, the accumulated population growth really started to press in a number of areas. First, prices started to go up, especially prices of food and land. Second, the elites, which had been fairly generous in voting taxes to Elizabeth to defend Protestant England against Catholic Spain and so on, they started to look around and say, population's going up, prices are going up. Some of these farmers who have managed to commercialize their lands and make good profits are starting to kind of jump up socially and, make more of themselves. And so you see in the elites a kind of sudden fracturing where some of the elites become very conservative and start to say, we have to reinforce ourselves around the king and give ourselves a greater control of parliament and greater control of the counties. But other parts of the elite say, you know, we're facing kind of a crisis here. A lot of farmers are not able to get land while other farmers are buying up the land and getting rich. And so we have both more vagrancy and more kind of rich peasants. That's kind of weird. The government doesn't seem to know what it's doing. It keeps pushing up taxes, even though the inflation is really, we think, the fault of the government, so they shouldn't be raising taxes to deal with higher prices. So among this group of the elite, they felt society has lost its way and has become immoral. And they turned to Puritanism, as it was called, but they just felt they were going to be more kind of rigorous religious reformers and say, we're going to, you know, call people back to virtue. We want people to be closer to God, closer to the Bible. We don't want the flirting with Catholicism. And so the elite very clearly started to fracture. We also see a huge increase in the number of people going to Cambridge and Oxford and the Lincoln's Inn, the courts of law, because they were struggling to get ahead at a time when kids couldn't simply inherit from their parents because now there were more kids in each elite family. So social mobility started to kind of lock up and falter. The elite started to fracture. The government was getting into debt because of inflation and resistance to taxation. And ordinary people were starting to run into shortages of land. As the labor market got more and more flush, real wages started to deteriorate. And everybody had their own diagnosis of what was wrong. And that's why a lot of the talk you hear about this time is, we have a sense of disorder. How do we reestablish order? And the king had an idea. I know how I'll reestablish order. I'll make everybody in my kingdom follow the same prayer book. If I can get everybody to read from the same page, everything will work smoothly. It was a simple idea. And it didn't work at all because the Scottish Presbyterians didn't want to go along with that. They didn't want to have to go by the Anglican prayer book. So James started a rebellion in Scotland. He also sent his people, Charles I. Charles I started a rebellion in Scotland. He sent his people to Ireland to, let's have a tougher rule in Ireland. I need more tax revenues. You go out there and suck whatever you can from the Irish. Well, that started a rebellion in Ireland. And once the Scots and the Irish were in rebellion, the British nobility, instead of saying, oh yeah, let's rally around the king, they split. Half of them did rally around the king, and they became the Cavaliers who assembled at Oxford. But the other half said, this king has made a mess of things. We need to create a new era, a new Commonwealth. And so you had Commonwealth men who united with parliamentarians in London and said, we're going to oppose the king, and we're going to take the country back to where we think it should be. And so that led essentially to the British Revolution. And all of these pieces, population growth, struggling for ordinary people, elite divisions, and financial trouble for the crown, can be very clearly traced in the historical data. Then, what was the next case you wanted me to look at?
That's a clear kind of illustration of the principles that you're talking about. The other one was the American Civil War. So were those conditions for the British Civil War that you've talked about that seem to really map very strongly onto your model, how do we see them present in America in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, in leading up to the war in 1860?
Right. Well, it's funny. The American Civil War has been a subject of huge arguments. Was it about slavery? Was it about states' rights? Was it really a revolution, or was it just kind of a civil war that totally different. And to be honest, it was not a case that I had expected or worried about applying my model to. But as I mentioned earlier, my friend Peter Turchin, who actually is a biologist, he's a specialist in ecology, he said, and he's been working with my model for a while, he said, Jack, what if we applied your model to America in the 19th century? Because it's such a contentious period and no one really has a good explanation. What if your model works? And I said to Peter, I would be surprised, but go ahead and try it. And so Peter developed the measures and cranked the data, and sure enough, the model actually worked extremely well in identifying the middle third of the 19th century as a period of exceptional conflict. It's certainly true that slavery played into this, because you had a situation where the elites of the North and the South became increasingly polarized. The pattern of voting in the U.S. Congress went from a certain amount of bipartisan cooperation, even in the Jacksonian era, that just really started to unravel, to where the Whigs and the Democrats almost started fighting with each other on the floor of Congress because the slavery issue for the new territories was so divisive. So the political polarization was quite obvious, but it turned out when you dug in, there was also the same kind of surge of new mobility, because in the 19th century, as the new lands in the Louisiana Purchase were being settled, there was this huge effort by people to take advantage of those new lands and carve out new lives for themselves. And then the question was, how are these people going to fit those new communities into the United States? Are they going to be recognized as independent leaders? Are they going to be subordinated to the free states? Are they going to join the slave states? And so this social mobility, which started to be very open when those territories were settled, ran into this problem of, if these territories, which are filling up with people, are going to play a role in national government, they have to become states. They have to have representatives in Congress, and they have to have senators. But if they get those things, in other words, if the doors are open for these new colonists in the new territories to become part of our political elite, we have to ask if they're going to be slave or free, because that's going to tip the balance in a very polarized government. And so it was impossible to settle this problem of, how do we give political access and status and leadership roles to the upwardly mobile people in the new territories without it feeding back and amplifying the divisions over slavery? Now, it was also the case that during the 19th century, the North, which was the commercial trading and manufacturing center of the country, was getting rich, and the owners of large slave plantations in the South were getting rich, but a lot of the ordinary farmers in both the New England and Ohio Valley area and the ordinary white farmers in the South were not doing so well. That is, the early 19th century was a period of increased polarization and inequality in wealth. And that led to a lot of kind of soul searching. Southerners felt that we have to get the North off our backs if we're going to realize our potential and get better. And Northerners felt we have to get rid of the competition of slavery in order for ordinary workers and farmers to do well. So this polarization of wealth meant you had large numbers of people, both in the North and South, who saw conflict and settling that conflict as a way to make sure that their life and their family and their opportunity would be unimpeded and improved. And then the government, of course, became increasingly hamstrung and unable to function as the Congress got more and more polarized. So it turns out, if you map these indicators, they do a very good job of tracking the increased anger, divisions, and potential for conflict. So even the Civil War is very different.
The interesting thing is that you would think of the model of America at that period, because of the expansionist possibilities for the the colonial settlers, and the fact that they had a pretty major kind of industrial army backing them up against the native peoples of America, you would think that that would provide a model of opportunity for people. But what you seem to be suggesting is that those opportunities were all being sucked up towards the top because of this kind of, well, in the South, presumably because of the model of the sort of landowning aristocracy type model. And in the North,
that's
because
right.
It was in the North, it was the industrial magnate. So although you would imagine that there was lots of space for the expansion economically for ordinary people, that space was being closed down constantly, no matter how far territorially they were pushing.
That's right. It was a period of expansion, but remember, the United States economy, you know, has been expanding for the last 30 or 40 years also. It's just that most of the gains of that growth in the U.S. recently have been sucked up by digital media and finance, and more of profit is going to executive salary and benefits and not to ordinary workers. And sort of the same thing was true. The 19th century was a period of expansion, but in the early 19th century, a disproportionate share of the benefits of that expansion went to the people on top, either large plantation owners in the South or people who were business and property owners and bankers and manufacturers in the North. The kind of ordinary farmers in upstate New York, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, or the whites who were not large slaveholders in the South had no way to kind of compete. So they did get somewhat better off, but relative to the wealthy, they were falling behind. And The alternative for those who had the nerve and the courage was to go to the frontier and to settle some of the new territories that were opening up in the Northwest and Oklahoma and so on. But those new territories didn't have any political representation. And then dealing with that made the problem of slavery kind of exacerbated. Which way do the new territories go? And that problem turned out to break the Union.
So in a sense, what happened is what we saw in the British kind of model is that once the elites became fractured, they effectively recruited on that sense of injustice onto their own projects, in a sense.
Exactly.
So that,
yes.
And they identified, right, we need a revolution, but the revolution is actually about overthrowing that group, whether it's, you know, overthrowing the Yankees from the point of view of the southern slave states or the other way around. So the revolution is actually an elite coordinated revolution against another sector of the elite rather than, you know, a populist uprising from underneath. But it still fits the model.
In fact, all revolutions fit what you just described. All revolutions involve one portion of the elite recruiting supporters to fight against another portion of the elite. That's what I just described in the British with the Cavaliers and the Puritans.
Yeah,
it was true.
Yeah.
It was true of the French with the bourgeoisie, first against the aristocracy, and then the more radical Jacobins against the kind of more conservative nationalist Brissotin. This mythology that a revolution is simply a matter of the poor rising up against the rich is just a myth. It's a beautiful Victor Hugo type novel, but if it's only the poor rising up against the rich, the poor get slaughtered. That's the lesson.
Right. So
history.
That's a really key point, actually, that in that model that applies. So in terms of the Chinese Revolution, we have a mythology around the leadership who eventually took over in 49, Mao and the rest of it, that tells the story that they are not an elite. But what you seem to be suggesting is they're an intellectual elite, in a sense, rather than a kind of aristocratic elite, that they're driven by their intellectual outlook towards a set of ideologies, and then they provide the leadership. So again, this is the final time I ask you to do it, I promise, in terms of a specific example. Let's apply the model to what happened in China, because that is a long revolution. I mean, Mao's fighting in 1918, he's on the streets, and you know it's 30 years later before he marches into Beijing. So, what's going on there?
The Chinese Revolution, or you should say revolutions, really starts with the collapse of the old imperial regime in 1911. And the Chinese emperor represented a kind of long line of Manchu imperial leaders that had ruled China since 1644. And over those centuries, China had been prosperous but failed to keep up with modern technology. And so when the British came with steamboats and modern guns and knocked China back in the Opium Wars, it started what the Chinese now call a century of humiliation from the 1840s to the 1940s.
And as a Brit, I have to step in and say that I always find it absolutely extraordinary, especially when you have people who take a kind of nationalistic tone about history. You know, that, for instance, we've had all Black Lives Matter and the statues of colonialists and slave owners has been a big kind of culture war topic, mostly, you know, the right using it. But we're not taught in British history that we went to war with China three times because they wouldn't buy opium off us and were objecting to their population becoming addicted to narcotics. It's always mind-boggling to me that people who talk about history and the national project of history, they're always only looking in the areas that tell the story they're interested in telling. And the Opium Wars are a particularly shameful and incredible episode in British history that, you know, it's not even taught in schools. I didn't know that at school and I studied history. So it's just a crazy, you know, we're taught Elizabeth, we're taught Henry VIII had six wives, we're taught the Second World War and the First World War. We're not taught about the slaughters in Srinagar or, you know, the Opium Wars, are we? You know, that's part of the... Anyway, I'm kind of going off down a rabbit hole, but that's part of the project of politicising history, isn't it? You look where you want to look. But the Opium Wars are an extraordinary bit of British history, I think, anyway. But sorry to interrupt, but please do carry on. 100 years of humiliation...
Yes, but I'm trying to paint it a little bit from the Chinese point of view, because China has become a hugely important country in the world, and we need to understand their viewpoint of their history. So they see the kind of the 1840s as the beginning of Western pressure. In the 1850s, there was a big civil war that really undermined the ability of the imperial government to continue to run the country. It took help both from kind of local wealthy landowners and also from some Western powers for the Chinese government to restore order. But the government was really quite seriously weakened, and as the 19th century went on, more and more Chinese started to see that the way of the future would be finding a way to be strong enough to compete with these Western powers, not just the British, but the Germans, the Americans, the French, all of whom kind of took out little sectors along the Chinese coast and made it their own. So the Chinese were anxious because they felt their system of government was letting them down. It wasn't defending the country. It wasn't providing the goods that Westerners were coming in and providing. So urban groups, they started to build railways in China. They started to set up their own cotton and silk factories. And the merchants in the cities started to see the imperial government as just more and more of a problem. They wanted a modern government with a new kind of modern national vision. And so in 1910, 1911, there were a series of protests in Chinese cities. Parts of the military who had been modernized under imperial supervision decided that this was actually an opportunity to take the modernization of China forward. And so the military did not put down the riots in the cities, but instead kind of went to the emperor and said, look, you got to give us control here. We know how to modernize things. We've been modernizing the military for a couple of decades. And the emperor resigned. And at first, it seemed like they were going to build a modern republic. The intellectual leader of this movement, Sun Yat-sen, who had studied in Japan and was close to the Americans and wanted to set up a modern constitutional democracy, managed to organize and hold national elections. But then one of the military leaders felt that, this really should be something the military takes charge of. And so Yuan Shikai, who was one of the top military honchos, declared that he would be the leader of the country. And that essentially started a long period of civil war with different military leaders who controlled troops in different parts of the country, claiming that they were the governor or the leader of their province. And there really was no national government for several decades after the emperor stepped down in 1911. But in the 1920s, one of Sun Yat-sen's associates, Chiang Kai-shek, started to really organize his section of the military into a modern, efficient force. He took foreign assistance, and he started a military campaign to reunify the country. Now, he wasn't the only leader in China who saw that this was a disaster and something needed to be done. His approach was to create a military regime that would reunify the country. In the cities, there were intellectuals who decided that maybe communism is the way to go forward. That you look at Russia, and they were a poor peasant country, and communism allowed them to stand up to the West. They had started to rebuild their society. And so a circle of communists started organizing in the cities. But Chiang Kai-shek saw that as a danger. And so he sent the military into the cities to wipe out the communists as best he could. And that forced Mao and the other communists to take off to the countryside and rethink about how to hide and organize there. Now, China had been a prosperous pre-industrial country. But as it moved into the 20th century, the combination of kind of Western imperialism and technological backwardness reduced China to a weaker and weaker economy. And with population growth, things actually started to get pretty desperate for much of the peasantry, especially as we get into the 20s. In the 30s, they're affected by the global depression, which affects trade. And then the Japanese, who had actually been building up their economy since the 19th century, decided, we're a big country, we're a powerful country now, Japan is. We should be like the Western countries and have imperial possessions, just like the British and other countries, the French and so on. So the Japanese invaded first Manchuria, and then in the 1930s, they pushed further all the way into China, down to Nanjing in the center of the country. That prevented Chiang Kai-shek from consolidating his military regime. Now he had to fight the Japanese, even as he was trying to hunt down and destroy the remainder of the communists who were trying to organize peasant villages in the interior. But because the Japanese were the bigger threat, the nationalist military elite under Chiang Kai-shek and the kind of communist intellectual elite who was trying to organize peasants united. They said, let's make a common cause because we've got to get rid of the Japanese. They're a threat to all of us. Now, during that period of common cause against the Japanese, the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek did most of the fighting, but their government grew much more kind of corrupt and were seen as unjust and arbitrarily violent, and they take over a portion of China from the Japanese and just seize everything that they could. The communists, although they did also contribute to the fighting against the Japanese, they were also trying to organize the peasantry, and they presented themselves as kind of saviors to the peasantry. They say, we're going to help you. We're going to reduce the rents and the taxes that you have to pay. We're going to keep your landlords from exploiting you, and we're going to be on your side and help you. So they were kind of recruiting more and more of China's rural population, which is the overwhelming part of China's population, to their side. So as we get into the 1840s and the Japanese start to get pushed back.
Sorry, you said 1840s, you mean 1940s.
1940s, yep, sorry, forgive me. It's a long century of humiliation from the 1840s to the 1940s.
And it's a long bit of summary that I've asked you for. So.
No, that's okay. But anyway, let me wrap up. In the 1940s, you have these two different elites in China, the kind of communists who have pulled themselves from the kind of intellectual, radical socialist faction of the modernizing elite. And then you have Chiang Kai-shek, a kind of more traditional military nationalist, also modernizing section of the elite. So by this time, all of the elites realize the old imperial state is gone, and thank goodness it's gone, because dealing with Japan, dealing with Russia, we have to be a modern country. We have to build a kind of somehow new modern state. The only question is it going to be a communist state the way Mao and his supporters want, or is it going to be a military nationalist state like Chiang and his supporters want? So the elites are in conflict. The population has suffered from war and depression and is desperate to follow someone who will lead them forward. And because the nationalists, frankly, were not good at governance, they were pretty corrupt and ineffective in domestic governance, whereas the communists at least had a wonderful story to tell about we're going to help you. And in fact, the communists, they did organize well. They sent people into the villages, talked to peasants, asked them what were their grievances. They kind of organized teams to improve irrigation and harvest and help the peasants. And so Mao was able to get the bulk of popular support, and then he made a deal with the Soviet Union and Stalin to also, you know, you give me weapons, we'll have a communist victory here. And so once the Japanese were beaten down by America in the Pacific and started to retreat in China, the Maoists and the nationalists started fighting against each other. And the Maoists, with more popular support and with strong Soviet financial and arms support, were able to push the nationalists all the way off the mainland, off to the island of Taiwan. And in 1949, Mao was able to march into Beijing and declare the beginning of the communist regime. But of course, this was the end of a long, decades-long fight in which first the imperial government had collapsed, then different elites had taken opposing sides, the population had suffered terribly, and really kind of in the absence of any national government at all after the Japanese invasion, both the nationalists and the communists had to fight their way to power. And that, of course, finally led to the Proclamation of the People's Republic in 1949 and the communist regime that was going to end the century of national humiliation. And certainly since then, China has grown and China has recovered a place as a major country in the world. So give them some credit for doing what they said they'd do.
Yeah. So again, we looking at those conditions is population, there's dysfunctional government, there's elites willing to challenge one another. So all of those sort of conditions are met in all three of those cases.
Well, the trick is you can't apply the model too mechanically One has to be aware. One component of the model is government financial weakness and dysfunction. So you have to say, how did this particular government in China or US in the 19th century or Britain, how did that government get into trouble? What were the obstacles to acquiring adequate revenue, to having the loyalty of the elite? And that they were different obstacles in each case. But the bottom line was the government could not function. And then you say, what were the factors that divided the elites? Well, the particular division is going to be different in each historical period. What they all have in common is elites could not agree on how to rebuild the government in a time of crisis. And they differed so fiercely that they were willing to fight a civil war in each of these three cases to determine the nature of the future government. And then the third factor is, you know, what was happening to inequality and popular living standards and the proportion of income and growth that was going to the elite versus going to the ordinary workers. And of course, who is the elite differs in each of these three cases. But in all three cases, what we characteristically see is ordinary people feeling that they were unjustly losing out to elites who were unjustly benefiting from and securing an elite position and shutting them off or taking resources away from them. So the pattern is there.
So in a sense, you know, there's a false distinction between a civil war and a revolution, because one of the things that you've clearly pointed out is that all revolutions require one part of the elite to be on board. That means effectively we're always got some form of elite involved. That means they're always a form of civil war, whether they're expressed violently or like the Orange Revolutions, just, you know, by people on the street or whatever. It's almost a false distinction, because the civil war is the revolution that means that the system afterwards is never going to be the same as it was before. Is that a sort of fair summary?
Yes, I think so. It's important to point out that revolutions in themselves have a changing character over time. So in the 20th century, revolutions are occurring in countries with older populations. And one of the things that we've learned is younger populations are more likely to be drawn to radicalism and violence. Older populations are more likely to lean toward peaceful demonstrations and seek a kind of democratic transition through protest and reform rather than radical violence, if that's at all possible. So the revolutions in Ukraine, in Georgia, the so-called color revolutions are particularly characteristic of more mature populations that are trying to correct injustice and fight an authoritarian government, but they do so through nonviolent revolution as much as possible. So that element has changed. But the other characteristics are as you summarized.
Thanks for staying with the podcast. I'm passionate about real conversations which take time. The standard media is very constrained in its content by format, advertisers, and especially by time, which is why it's important to have spaces like this for real dialogue. Please do engage with me, sign up for updates, and sponsor the podcast via Patreon. The next episode of the podcast is a conversation with Tristan Guttridge, a biologist with a passion for sharks. In fact, he describes himself as a shark fanatic. With a PhD in behavioural ecology based on research he undertook at the Shark Lab in Bimini, Bahamas, Tristan has many strings to his bow as he advocates for greater understanding and protection of sharks. In addition to continued shark research, Tristan has become a well-known presenter on Discovery Channels, and I worked with him in March 2021 for a programme for Discovery Shark Week, which will broadcast in August 2021. With his wife Annie, Tristan has also founded a non-profit called Save the Blue, which enables volunteers to learn more about shark research as well as providing education programmes for school children in the Bahamas. Much of his work is based in the waters around Andros Island in the Bahamas, a uniquely pristine barrier reef environment with a trench of very deep water, the tongue of the ocean, directly alongside, and a huge area of protected marine reserve. We had a very intense shoot schedule, including multiple night shoots and dives, but we were able to have a conversation on the final day while we were packing to leave. I learned a lot about sharks, and Tristan's enthusiasm is infectious. In the meantime, stay safe and keep an open mind.